loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Chinese government officials have condemned the Trump administration's move to prepare a new round of tariffs targeting $200 billion of goods and vowed to respond with measures of their own. How far is Donald Trump willing to take this trade war? Next, the Trump administration is cutting most of the funds previously provided to groups that help people get insurance under Obamacare and will push them to promote plans that lack the law's benefits and protections. Then, which two companies have more lobbyists than Amazon, Microsoft, and Walmart combined? How about Uber and Lyft? The ride-sharing services have used cold, hard cash and an army of lobbyists to convince 41 state legislatures to pass laws exempting them from regulations that taxi drivers have to abide by. And then thousands of nurses, teachers, and government staff members went on strike in New Zealand yesterday for the first time in a generation. The action was taken because workers have not received a raise in 9 years. And finally, Rupert Murdoch, CEO of 21st Century Fox, with a net worth of $15.9 billion, has upped his bid to buy Sky News. Comcast is also competing to buy Sky. Either way, we'll see further media consolidation in an industry already owned by billionaires. Who and how many control the media that we consume? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to what looks like a bona fide trade war between the United States and China. Chinese government officials have condemned the Trump administration's move to prepare a new round of tariffs targeting $200 billion worth of goods and vowed to respond with measures of their own. How far is Donald Trump willing to take this trade war? We're joined from New York by Pete Dolak. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And we're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome to both of you.
Hi there.
Glad to be here.
Jude, let's start with you. We spoke with you about a week ago, and we talked about this very issue. And we talked about how tariffs would do nothing but hurt both sides. And there was some belief, at least here in the mainstream media in the United States, that this was just a little pinprick that the Trump administration was trying to inflict on the Chinese, just to make the Chinese understand that he was serious about trying to renegotiate some of these trade deals. But $200 billion worth of goods having new tariffs levied against them is more than a pinprick. What's the strategy here?
Well, I think we've discussed this before, is what is the end game? Well, Trump is betting on the fact that the US is stronger than China, and in the end can bend China to its will. I think that's the only conclusion that can be drawn. As we've discussed before, this is nothing to do with trade deficits. It is to do with stopping China developing technologically. China is losing some lower paid jobs to other countries which have lower wages, like Vietnam, etc., because it's moving up the value chain, wages are higher, and it has to move up the value chain technologically so the goods it's producing are of a higher value. Otherwise, it will end up with a deficit. That's what China is trying to do, and Trump is trying to stop it. It's as simple as that.
Pete Dolak, you are involved with trade justice issues. What's the justice in these tariffs? Are these tariffs helping or hurting the average American?
That's a good question. I suspect they may ultimately hurt rather than help the average American. I think the suggestion just now that this is more of a case of Trump trying to show everybody, the world, and China included, you know, who's the toughest guy. Probably that's the single biggest motivation for Trump, I suspect. And of course, a lot of this policy is being driven by Robert Lighthizer, who's the United States trade representative, and he's a longtime corporate lawyer who's a longtime hawk on China and China trade issues. I'm not so sure there really is any kind of coherent strategy here. I don't really see that. What we're seeing is tit for tat. You know, Trump announces some sanctions. China announces that, well, they will counter with an identical amount. Today, Trump is saying that, well, we're going to go take it a step further and we're going to apply another $200 million. And he's threatening to up it as much as $500 billion, the supposed size of the U.S.-China trade deficit. What Trump thinks he's going to gain by this, I don't really know. I mean, Trump is somebody who I don't think really understands how these sorts of issues work. He's got people like Lighthizer whispering in his ear, and of course he always likes to posture as he's the toughest guy in the room here. So it's really hard to say where this is all going to go and if this is going to spiral out of control. It hasn't yet, but it certainly is the possibility that it could.
Jude Woodward, when I'm reading the Wall Street Journal, which I do pretty much regularly daily, the Wall Street Journal in general appears to be more or less opposed to a trade war with China. But at the same time, at least in their news coverage, they believe that the United States has leverage over China and that China will, in fact, be hurt more than the United States will be hurt by a trade war. One of the points they are making, for instance, is that China imports a huge amount of soybean products from the United States. Now, they said that they were going to impose tariffs on soybeans, and that would hurt agricultural interests in predominantly Republican states. But the actual demand for soybeans so great, and the supply, in fact, the global supply limited enough that China can't easily wean itself off of that product. And the Wall Street Journal has been itemizing the different ways in which because of the relative underdevelopment still of the Chinese economy, at least in aggregate terms, that they will in fact be the loser here. Do you see it that way? And I'm also, while you're answering that question, I'm just looking at Global Times, which is of course an unofficial website, but one that frequently reveals the attitude of the Chinese Communist Party. The lead editorial today is "Respond to U.S. Trade Extortion Resolutely." Again, less diplomatic language than one normally hears from China.
Yeah, well, I think China has so far at least responded by saying it's going to stand up to this. It's not going to be bullied. It's not going to be pushed around. As to who will suffer most, it's difficult because certainly China will find it, well, it's not going to try and wean itself off soybean. It can't possibly, it's staple to the tofu and soybean products are staple to the Chinese diet. It's just going to have to get them from elsewhere, even if they're more expensive. But is that going to hurt China more than the rise in commodity prices because of the tariffs on China are going to hurt the American consumer of electronic goods? People are talking about, well, production will move out of China. Certainly some production will move out of China, but that can't be on the scale of production that currently takes place in China. That's a decade to move it out of China. So that's not going to happen. On the one hand, China's trade with the US, I think, is only $180 billion. So it can't actually respond to $200 billion or $250 billion because it doesn't have that value of exports from the US to target. On the other hand, other economic estimates I've seen have said that this will lead to approximately a fall in GDP growth of 0.5%. Well, 0.5% of 2.5% or 3%, which is the US's growth rate, is a bigger chunk than 0.5% of 6 or 6.5%, which is China's growth rate. So who is going to be hurt worst? Who is going to suffer most? I think all we can say is this is destructive for world trade. It's destructive for the productive economy, and it will, in the end, it will rebound on U.S. consumers.
Pete Dolak, these are what I'm about to refer to as maybe a bit ephemeral, but because it's about approval ratings for Trump. But for the first time since he's become president, January 2017, the majority of Americans approve of Trump's handling of the economy, according to a CNBC survey. Just read a couple sentences. Trump's economic approval rating surged 6 points to 51%, according to the latest CNBC All-America Economic Survey. 54% say the economy is good and excellent, the highest recorded by CNBC in 10 years of the survey. The recent headlines on immigrations have not hurt his ratings, according to the survey. Trump has carved out a position of xenophobia against immigrants, racism against Latinos in particular, and also a feeling that he's defending the American worker by taking on the big giants, and he's doing it unabashedly, unafraid. It would seem to me that while as much as we here despise Donald Trump and his policies, that this could actually be resonating, but maybe not, because again, these are, you know, surveys. What's your take on it? I mean, you're trying to keep your finger to the pulse.
I suspect, as you initially indicated, this is probably more ephemeral than any kind of permanent shifting. And I assume that 51% figure in the CNBC poll had to do strictly with his so-called handling of the economy and not his overall approval ratings, which seem to be pretty much stuck at around 40%. I mean, obviously, at this point, after all has gone on, that doesn't seem like there's going to be much of anything that could possibly shake Trump's base. And obviously, there's a great part of the country that is uniformly opposed to him. So you always have those floaters kind of in the middle who are up for grabs. And you see temporary things like the unemployment rate dropping and in the eyes of certainly of Trump's base, you know, he's standing tall against the Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, as we know, the real unemployment rate is considerably higher than the so-called official rate. I just had done a global survey a few weeks ago on that. And the U6 rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out, is about double the so-called official rate, and that's probably even that understates the true underemployment and unemployment rate in this country. But at least it's a little bit more realistic. So times aren't really as good as they might look on the surface. You know, the stock market is overvalued. At some point, it's going to start coming down. The country, unfortunately, is due for recession. That's just an ordinary cycles and boom and bust cycles of capitalism. The U.S. is certainly not exempt from that any more than any other capitalist country is. So sooner or later, this temporary, on the surface, paper feel good kind of stuff going by, I think is going to slip away there, and reality, I think, is going to start biting a little harder.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm very sorry that we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Pete Dolek. Pete's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues, and he's the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And we were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is cutting most of the funds previously provided to groups that help people get insurance under Obamacare and will push them to promote plans that lack the law's benefits and protections. We're joined from Bennington, Vermont by Mary Gerrish, an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. Mary, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the work you're doing to let people know exactly what the administration is doing to undermine our health care.
Well, thank you very much. And we feel the same way about you. And that's actually how I wanted to start. The last time you were on the show, we talked about the administration's inability to kill Obamacare by repealing it in Congress. But it appears now that they're trying to kill it by 1,000 cuts. Do you think this is one of those cuts?
I'm sure that it is. I mean, two things really right on the heels of each other. Suspending payments relative to the risk apportionment issues and telling the insurance companies that they can't have them, which will in turn raise the premiums for everybody. And then at the same time, cutting more than a third of the money for navigators and saying that they can't even get that unless they can prove that they've been talking to people about these other plans being the ones that don't fall under Obamacare. And so by doing this, he can essentially undermine the whole Affordable Care Act. And, you know, the insurance companies are making a lot of noise about, oh, no, we don't like this. You know, this is terrible that he suspended payments because, oh, gee, now we're going to have to increase premiums for next year. And oh, gee, maybe we shouldn't be participating in these exchange, healthcare exchanges, because even the Justice Department won't help us out in court on this stuff. It's just like, if you can't overturn it, just make it fail by sabotaging it in every way possible. And that's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, this is a 70% cut in funding from just 1 year ago. That's according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And it's going to make it that much harder for people who can't navigate the system by themselves to get insurance. And for whatever reason, that appears to be the Trump administration's plan, is that it's better for fewer people to have health insurance.
Right. And it's just crazy because, like, at first he cuts down the enrollment season, right? And people don't know about that. And in terms of people navigating the system without these navigators, I want to tell you that I have friends that are navigators. They can't even hardly navigate the system, let alone putting somebody in there that really does not know the terminology, that may not be as good with a computer, and they're just not going to get health care. And I can't help but think this is just a, like, okay, well, if a lot of people can't get health care, a lot of people will die. And that's okay, because all the government expenses, but, you know, the healthy people who pay a lot of taxes will still be there, right? Because they can afford their own health care. It's all the people that can't afford their own health care that are going to fall by the wayside. You know, since the attitude seems to be with this administration that they're not really worth anything anyway, they'd probably prefer to let them die. And I feel like that's just contrary to everything that our humanity stands for.
Yeah.
I mean, the level of criminality for the Trump administration, all over the country, you're trying to take people who are the most vulnerable. And when we talk about the most vulnerable, we're not talking about a small group. We're talking about, you know, 90% of the population of this country has an average family income of $34,000. So trying to deprive people by one means or another, if they couldn't repeal the Affordable Care Act, which of course has many, many defects and flaws, but if they couldn't repeal it, they're just going to sabotage it by depriving people of essential services for themselves and for their children or for their grandparents. We had Mary in the state of Kentucky because the Republican governor in Kentucky, Bevins, couldn't have the court approve his waivers program, whereby poor people had to show that they were, quote, working or engaged in efforts to fill out the paperwork for work. If they couldn't do that, they weren't going to be able to have health care. So he just cut 500,000 people off of their dental and vision programs on Friday because the court said what he was trying to do was unconstitutional. I mean, this is just crass brutality by rich people.
And don't forget that just a month ago, less than a month ago, the Justice Department said that it would no longer defend Obamacare in federal court cases. And there are 20 separate federal court cases pending against it.
That's right. And that is clearly an effort to sabotage, because if they're not defending, then the other side is going to win. I mean, let's just face it. And so they're really totally tipping the scale through the legal system, or I should say abuse of the legal system, as well as through abuse of executive orders and policy, as well as out and out threats to legislators about what they'll do to their careers if they don't go along with it. We have a bully in the White House, and it's a bully who doesn't have any heart and would rather see people die than be getting government-provided health care. And that's not right on so many levels, and it's totally contrary to the whole history of our country and the spirit of our Constitution. And it's an embarrassment to us in the eyes of the rest of the world.
Mary, I wanted to ask you, the administration has used these regulatory powers that we're talking about to undermine the ACA on multiple fronts. There's a Republican-controlled Congress. Where do we get to the point of no return? What is the point of no return, where Obamacare ceases to be what it was originally meant to be and just is simply not helping people anymore?
I really think we are at that point. And that's why I'm so excited about the improved Medicare for All bills that are being proposed. And at this point in time, and we, all we have to do is look at other issues to realize that literally the administration thinks that it's okay for people. I mean, look at the craziness with sending a one-year-old baby to court when it's when that parent has been deported already. I mean, what that is just, even Republicans who have wanted to support the president because he's part of their party are appalled. And there's no, I don't think there's a strong enough word, actually, for the visceral reaction that people have to this. And he's doing the same thing with healthcare of letting people die. But unfortunately, people die alone, afraid, and without medical care. And so there's not the publicity or the record of it. But it's our job as people in this country and as human beings to bring those stories out so that we can, in fact, have an improved Medicare for all and make sure that people aren't dying because they don't have the money to pay for medical care.
Yeah. In one way here, and I think it's important to bring this out, you know, it's the ACA is complicated. When you call or try to sign up with the exchanges, you can go through all sorts of hoops. That's why having these third party or NGOs or others sort of help people get, you know, wade through all the bureaucratic and red tape to get their health care. That's why it's important. But on the other hand, why should it be this complicated? I mean, if you had a Medicare for all, improved Medicare for all, you don't have to like navigate through 1,800 different plans and do this and do that. You're a human being and you have health care.
That's right. And you have a little card and you go to the doctor and swipe the card and the doctor gets paid and you get healthy. I mean, that is so much clearer and so much easier, and it doesn't have 25 bureaucratic levels, and it's going to be easier for the providers. It's going to be easier for everybody except the large insurance companies that are making so much money off of us right now by trying to avoid any restrictions of the ACA and setting up new plans where they sell you insurance that you can't use because you don't have the money for the co-pays or you don't have the money for the deductible. It's just insanity not to have improved Medicare for all. And, you know, I was at a meeting in Minneapolis about 2 weeks ago where it was, in fact, it was a Healthcare Now organized the event, but it was a strategy conference for improved Medicare for all. And it's amazing how many states are getting on this bandwagon and saying, okay, we have to do this. We're going to start state provisions and try and get state legislation, and we're going to work for the federal legislation at the same time because this just has gone beyond anything that's tolerable to anybody that has any kind of a heart or conscience or morality.
We're going to have to leave it right there. That was the voice of Mary Garish. Mary joined us from Bennington, Vermont. She's an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Which two companies have more lobbyists than Amazon, Microsoft, and Walmart combined? How about Uber and Lyft? The ride-sharing services have used cold, hard cash and an army of lobbyists to convince 41 state legislatures to pass laws exempting them from regulations that taxi drivers must abide by. We're joined from New York by Bhairavi Desai. She's the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You had a rally yesterday about this specific issue. Can you start by telling us a little about that?
Sure. Well, we've been campaigning for change. I mean, there is such a crisis in this race to the bottom for drivers across our industry in New York City. You know, there have been 6 suicides since November that we know of, and, you know, all due to the economic despair. also we've been rallying the city council to enact legislation such as a cap on the number of vehicles that companies like Uber and Lyft can use to saturate the streets. And there was a report out last week from the city, which was commissioned by the city, with the finding that 42% of the time, Uber and Lyft's vehicles are actually just idling empty. So there's not enough work for the drivers to begin with, and then, you're entrapping everybody else in congestion and making it harder for everybody to survive. But we wanted to make sure that the proposals that the regulatory agency put out in that report, which we see as just kind of rubber stamping the same Uber business practice that's led to this economic despair, we want to make sure that the city council doesn't follow that lead and instead continues to look for legislation that would have more legal weight and would have, would just be able to do more for drivers on the streets.
You are recommending some very specific changes. There are four points, actually. Can you tell us what those are?
Sure. Well, so our main points are that, one, we want to see a cap on the number of vehicles. So yellow cabs and green cabs, for example, have a cap. In order for the city to issue more permits, they have to go through the state legislature. But black cars, the sector that Uber and Lyft are in, there's no cap on the number of vehicles. And so today, we have over, in total in New York City, 130,000 cars all competing for the same set of fares that about 70,000 cars used to complete, just about 5 years ago. And out of the current 130,000, 13,000 are yellow cabs, and all the other vehicles, including 80,000 that are directly affiliated with Uber itself, all those other vehicles, all like close to 120,000, Uber, Lyft can either, they're directly affiliated or can dispatch. And so it's a saturation. We want to see a cap on the number of those vehicles. And given that there's a high turnover rate, as the vehicle licenses expire, or just are turned in, we want the city to not reissue them so that at least over time, the city can settle back down to the number of vehicles that, really works for everybody. Also, we want to see the yellow cab meter, which is regulated fares. It's the rate of fares that the companies can charge the passenger. We want to see those rates be regulated and required as the minimum fares that Uber, Lyft, and the other app-based companies can calculate and charge the passenger. Right now, whatever they charge the passenger remains unregulated. And they have found a way to charge the passenger one rate of fare and then pay the driver with a different rate of fare, which, we've found upon review of our data that the fare by which they reimburse the driver is at a lower rate than the fare by which they pay by which they collect payment from the public. And so we want the city to regulate that system and require that, first of all, they can't charge that, Uber, Lyft can't charge rate of fare lower than what the yellow cab rate is. And secondly, that they can't charge their own drivers, Uber, Lyft drivers, a different lower rate of fare. That we want there to be a regulated commission system by which Uber and Lyft drivers are paid. So these are the two main demands that the city's study, for example, directly oppose, even though the study itself says that actions like these, legislative, that would require legislation and not regulation by an agency, that the legislation would be stronger, but it's like, our regulator is giving the council an alternative. We see that as really problematic because in such a highly charged, political debate, you don't need an alternative to stray people's focus from what really should be done. I mean, we'd also like to see a fund, like a health fund, including for retirement and mental health services for drivers. It's something that we had about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and make a very long story short, it no longer exists, and it wasn't able to get off the ground because of litigation that the taxi companies filed, and the administration really, we feel, didn't back it up the way that they should have until we ended up losing that benefits fund. Well, we want the city council to pass legislation that would reinstate that fund. So, and this time extend it to the entire workforce. So, you know, drivers would have access to basic benefits and particularly retirement, 24-hour, you know, mental health hotline, both for drivers and their families, you know, vision, dental, eventually a group health plan, you know, as well.
We are speaking with Bhairavi Desai. She is the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. You know, Brian, it's not just money for lobbying that Uber and Lyft are known for, especially here in Washington. It's also money for advertising. They've been very smart about getting out in front of any other organization, any other company that might cause them problems, including taxis that have been around for nearly a century.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about what the bosses at Uber contribute, the number that comes up is zero. Because what do they actually do? They don't drive. It's not their cars. They have no responsibility, really, no liability. They take the riders' money. They carry out wage theft, as Bhairavi is discussing, wage theft against the drivers. And then they use that money to pay politicians, one, pay politicians so that they can be exempted from basic health and safety and worker protection regulations. And two, they use it for advertising to snuff out competition. So it's a management model that is based on monopoly practices, organized, I would say, corruption, although it's called lobbying. And the employers, the management, actually contributes nothing. I mean, if they all went to sleep or went into a coma, nothing would change. I mean, the drivers would still be driving. It's driven by an app.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like human beings are actually, these bosses are doing anything.
No, these guys came up with some software. They wrote some code, and then they got rich on the backs of workers.
Go ahead, Bhairavi.
Absolutely, and it's just such, you know, I mean, we know there's exploitation of workers across our economy, but there is something very particular to what's going on today in the so-called gig economy, right, where, you know, these companies are using the technology, right, the software that they've programmed to essentially argue for a different business model, a business model that's predicated on part-timing, full-time jobs, that's predicated on, you know, undoing the employment model where workers are protected under labor law. I mean, the fact that Uber and Lyft in 2016, you know, paid more to lobbyists than Amazon, Walmart, and Microsoft combined is just a staggering fact. And it particularly given that, you know, the gig economy as a whole, right? Like these two companies as well. So not, you know, the ride hailing companies, but as well also like TaskRabbit and Handy and these other, you know, so-called like platform economy companies, they represent less than 1% of the total economy. Yet they're outspending on lobbyists than, you know, some of the world's largest corporations that have, you know, and by large, I mean, not only in terms of revenue, but also in terms of the size of their employee base. You know, now, you know, with this like record spending that companies like Uber and Lyft are doing, they're using it not just to deregulate local taxi regulations, but also to have laws that say that if the worker is dispatched by an app, regardless of the level of control the company has over them, that they cannot be considered an employee. You know, and so the worker doesn't have rights to like minimum wage and overtime and collective bargaining and, you know, a democratic union and even workers' compensation if they're injured on the job. So this is a serious attack on the working class in this country, you know, to undo labor law that, you know, you start with one set of vulnerable workers, but there's a trickle-down effect.
Yeah, and then you end up with a lot of different people having advantage taken of them.
It could be, John, I know we're almost out of time, but by 2020, as many as half of the workers in America could be in the so-called gig economy, what Bhairavi is talking about.
Just terrible. Well, that was the voice of Bhairavi Desai. She joined us from New York, and she's the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Thousands of nurses, teachers, and government staff members went on strike in New Zealand yesterday for the first time in more than a generation. The action was taken because workers have not received a raise in 9 years. We're joined from Auckland, New Zealand by Mike Treen. He's the national director of the Unite Union. And we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's the producer of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome, both of you.
Happy to be here.
Mike, let's start with you. I have to say that we don't get a lot of New Zealand news in the U.S. press, and I was shocked to see this in the Washington Post and in the Guardian saying that many workers, especially nurses and teachers, have not received a raise in 9 years, and that this is the first strike in 22 years. What's going on in New Zealand?
Well, I think a little bit of an exaggeration to say there's not been a raise in 9 years, but certainly real wages in real terms, the increases have been dragging down over the last decade and even more. So that in real wages, workers have been losing out. So yes, we've had a Tory, the 9 years has been, the last 9 years has been a right-wing a National Party government, a Tory government, and Labor just been elected, and workers are wanting to catch up on the decline in real wages they've suffered. So today, actually, right at this moment, 7 a.m., 30,000 nurses have gone on strike, and teachers are planning to go on strike soon. The primary teachers or the junior schools and the secondary teachers of both unions have voted for strike action. And my own union's had a number of strikes around, which is private sector union. But yeah, we've got cinema strikes, fast food strikes, and other things happening right at the moment.
So what's the government's reaction so far? Are they willing to go to the negotiating table and make this thing go away?
Well, they've tried to. So the wage offer for nurses has sort of doubled from $250 million they put aside for the nurses to $500 million put aside for the nurses. But, you know, nurses have calculated in terms of their real wages have declined by something like 18%, they think. Teachers have put in a wage claim for 16%. So though the government has changed, and now we have a Labor Party-led government, you couldn't describe it as particularly a left-wing Labor Party. You couldn't describe it that. No, that would be an exaggeration. And they've signed up to what they describe as the fiscal responsibility approach to life. So they're running a $3 billion government surplus, and while telling the nurses they don't have enough money to pay them any more than the $500 million they've allocated. So yes, they put aside a bit more for the nurses, or yes, so the election was just within the last 6 months. So the previous offer, which was 2% a year for 3 years, has been effectively been doubled. Nurses now are moving into action, and they've voted down. The last offer, the most recent offer, this $500 million one, was recommended by the bargaining group to be accepted, but it was rejected by nurses. Nurses are sort of waking up and saying, this is our chance to restore relativity. This is our star's chance to restore our real wages. And we're going to put a line in the sand. I don't quite know how the government's going to get themselves around this problem.
Let's take a step back. We're talking from Auckland, New Zealand, with Mike Treen. He's the national director of the Unite Union. We're talking about this huge wave of strikes that's going on in New Zealand. Mike, our audience here in the United States isn't going to be generally familiar with the political situation in New Zealand. Let's just take a step back. So you have the right-wing National Party, right? And they've been in power for a long time. But now there's this new Labour Party government led by Prime Minister Ardern that's recently taken power. How would you characterize that government, and how is the political situation affecting this strike movement?
This is a Labour Party, so it's a party that's based in the trade unions, but it's a very moderate Labour Party. And it's a coalition government with the Green Party, again, a very moderate Green Party. And it's also in coalition with a party called New Zealand First, which is actually a relatively socially conservative economic sort of nationalist party. So this is a bit of a mixed bag in terms of a government. And they signed up to what they called a fiscal responsibility program. So that meant that, you know, they've got to run budget surpluses, they've got to run down government debt, although, you know, the New Zealand government's got one of the lowest debt to GDP ratios in the world. And they've got to be, you know, moderate and generally in their approach, and government spending doesn't exceed more than 30% of GDP. I don't know what the exact number is, but you know, so they signed up and pledged this prior to the election. But it's also a government that, on a formal level, has repudiated some of the other neoliberal mantras. So it's pledged to reintroduce a free tertiary education, which is, you know, quite a big thing, and it's done that, but, you know, very slowly and moderately. So they introduced free tertiary education of 1 year in the first term of government, and they say we're going to elect them for another two, three-year terms to get the second and third year of free tertiary education. They also introduced they've pledged to increase the minimum wage to $20. By 2021, and started that with a 75 cent increase this year, and probably it'll be over a dollar a year for the next 3 years. And this is quite a significant pledge because that's going to take it from about 50% of the average wage to a little over 60% of the average wage. And we welcome that because many of our members are minimum wage workers, and a lot of the bosses are screaming about that policy. They've made it a little bit easier for union organising in terms of access to work sites and so on. But it's still, as I said, it's still in terms of its overall course, quite a moderate government. But these small openings in terms, and they formally repudiated some of the neoliberal past, because, you know, with some of these pledges include, and a small but significant increase in welfare entitlements. So for the first time, some have introduced a new universal entitlement for all newborn babies of $60 a week. And so they've opened the door, in a sense, to saying there can be an alternative course, but then they've tried to close the door again by saying, by not, in this, at least in this first term of government, not bringing in any new budgetary measures which would tax the rich, or we've got one of the lowest sort of, you know, we've got a very high sort of consumer tax, very low income taxes on the high income earners, low corporate tax rates, and so on. So they've got no new tax policy. So they've got no new income measures to fund the some of the heightened expectations among workers when this government came in. So they'd been talking to the unions, talking to the workers, talking to health sector workers, saying, yes, we're going to fix your problems. Yes, we understand you've fallen behind. Yes, we're going to make sure that teachers are valued, nurses are valued. And then when they get in, not being able to deliver these heightened expectations.
I want to ask you, Mike, we've got about a minute left. I want to ask you about politics. I'm looking at a piece in The Guardian here, and it says that nurses have not gone on strike in New Zealand for 30 years. The Minister of Health, David Clark, said that everyone agrees that nurses are underpaid. Primary school teachers, who voted overwhelmingly for a strike, but only for half a day, have not been on strike in 24 years. The Minister of Education is saying that everyone agrees that teachers are underpaid. This is a Labour government, and as you said, though, it's not a left-wing Labour government, but still it's a Labour government. So why is it that these strikes have to take place anyway? What is it about the politics of the current situation that is forcing people to the picket line?
Well, it's this commitment to not... Before the election, they committed to not introducing any new taxes on the rich. So they're constrained. And so if your income is sort of modest and you won't take the rich, then you're not going to have the money to be able to deliver for these groups who have seriously fallen behind in their real living standards. So this is a conundrum. It's a conundrum of their own making. I think it gives an opportunity for a discourse on actually a left-wing alternative for the country, and how that debate unfolds. The union's got to promote it. It's going to occur inside the Labour Party, and it may well, it will occur in parties outside the Labour Party. The Green Party also has had a big debate around these issues. So, yeah, it's opening the door, I think, to a more interesting political time ahead.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Auckland, New Zealand, by Mike Treen. He's the National Director of the Unite Union, and you can learn more about his union at www.unite.org.nz/about. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Rupert Murdoch, the CEO of 21st Century Fox with a net worth of $15.9 billion, has upped his bid to buy Sky News. Comcast is also competing to buy Sky. Either way, we'll see further media consolidation in an industry already owned by billionaires. Who and how many control the media that we consume? We're joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Tim, it's good to talk to you again.
Happy to be here with you.
Tim, a couple of months ago, I saw a video on YouTube. It made the rounds on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and everywhere else about several dozen local newscasters all reading off the same script. And the point was, and this was all true, of course, the point was that a very small number of companies, they tend to be very right-wing conservative companies, in that case, it was Sinclair Broadcasting, control the news that we consume. How much worse is it going to be if Rupert Murdoch is able to buy Sky?
We've entered this new phase of media consolidation. We have in the United States a much more permissive government when it comes to pro-corporate agenda, in particular, very large corporations. So not only do we see this effort by Murdoch to take over Sky, there's also, and he, of course, is in a bidding war with Comcast, which recently, or a couple of years ago, took over NBC Universal. On the other hand, he's selling some of his television properties, and Disney and Comcast are bidding for those. We have the Sinclair merger that you mentioned, Sprint, T-Mobile, which are the number three and four wireless carriers in the United States, are also have proposed a merger. So we're seeing this frenzied phase of mergers where a number of very powerful companies, and there are already only a few of them, are selling off bits of their companies to others and taking over others and telling regulators, that is the Department of Justice, the Federal Communications Commission, often intervene in approving these mergers that taking away competitors is actually good for consumers. So there's a lot of spin out there, but ultimately at the end of the day, it's a wave of new mergers that really put control over news and information, control over entertainment, control over communications, digital communications, wireless communications in the hands of fewer and fewer companies.
So tell me, if there were smaller companies or more independent companies or companies that did not have to answer to giant boards of directors made up of other millionaires and billionaires, what would media look like in this country?
It's a great question, and it's worth mentioning that the central tenet of the Federal Communications Commission when it was founded was to promote localism, diversity, and competition over the public airwaves. And it is, as a federal agency, has failed miserably to accomplish that task. And And the rationale then, which is this was back in the 1930s when they first formulated the FCC and to what it's become today, the rationale then was a very good rationale. The rationale that stands today is that in order for the media to support a democracy, in order for people to be engaged in civic affairs and to elect the right sorts of representatives, they need access to a diversity of viewpoints. And in order to accomplish that, you need a diversity of owners. That is to say, local television, national television, other media outlets that are competing directly with one another, that employ a number of journalists and present a diversity of viewpoints so that we can have open discourse and the sort of debate that is important to a successfully functioning democracy.
What really drives, from a business angle, what drives media consolidation? Is it just greed? Is it just avarice? Or are these business calculations based on a trend towards monopoly, which makes it sort of inexorable that each one of these corporate profit-driven, already mega or super or near monopolies keeps having to go down the same road? Is that what's driving it, or is it some other calculation?
It really is. I mean, to be honest, it really is driven by greed. Shareholders and the top executives of these companies make tens of millions of dollars from the completion of these sorts of mergers. But the irony to all of that is that in order for them to succeed in getting these mergers approved, they have to convince federal agencies that, one, it isn't an antitrust violation, that the joining of two very large companies doesn't present the sort of monopoly threats that would trigger the Department of Justice to file suit and to prevent the merger from going forward. And they also say that these efforts to enrich themselves are in the public interest. And so you'll often hear words like synergies, like, you know, the joining of Comcast with NBC Universal, which happened a number of years ago, presented synergies that would make for a more efficient company, fire up innovation, and serve customers better. But we found from that merger and from other mergers, AT&T bought up DirecTV, and that in the aftermath of these deals, that none of those synergies really occurred. What really resulted was higher prices for consumers and less choices when they boot up the internet or turn on their television set. So despite what they've told regulators, the results almost to the number have been fewer choices for consumers and higher prices.
Yeah. We're speaking from New York with Tim Carr. Tim is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Brian, I wonder if we're beyond a point where the average citizen can have some sort of an impact on this industry consolidation or these multi-billion dollar sales. Certainly Congress has never stepped in to stop anything like this. And even the Justice Department, which is supposed to rule on monopolies and monopoly or monopolistic takeovers, really doesn't. They almost automatically approve these kinds of things.
Well, you know, they did reject a number of years ago the AT&T Time Warner merger. So there have been instances where they have stepped in, but they have not been consistent in the way they address these mergers. And that's largely due to politics. We are now Donald Trump spoke out against the AT&T's recent takeover of Time Warner because he had an axe to grind against CNN, which is a Time Warner property. But at the end of the day, and even though his Department of Justice filed suit, their argument was very weak and the merger went through. So it varies from administration to administration. But I would argue that public involvement does make a matter, does make a difference, rather. It does matter. And that we have been successful in the past in getting hundreds of thousands of public comments into the FCC and slowing and stopping some of these mergers. Unfortunately, right now, the Federal Communications Commission is led by a chairman who doesn't pay much attention to the public. He has a very pro-corporate agenda. This is Ajit Pai, who's the chairman of the FCC, and tends not to listen to the public. So unfortunately, you know, we have to wait for the winds of the political winds to blow in another direction and to put in place a different chair and a different administration that might be more responsive to the public outcry over these sorts of mergers.
And Ajit Pai, who you're referring to, was, I think, the general counsel for Verizon once upon a time, not that long ago.
Yes, he served as one of their lawyers about a decade ago, and but since then he's, you know, even previously he was a commissioner at the FCC. He has consistently ruled in favor of large phone and cable companies, and has also been very involved in clearing away any of the regulatory obstacles that would stand in the way of a proposed merger of Sinclair, the company that you mentioned earlier that made this video that was repeated, or made the script that was repeated by all these local anchors. Sinclair is in the process of trying to take over Tribune Media, which is another large broadcast newspaper conglomerate. And Ajit Pai has removed a lot of the regulatory hurdles and obstacles that would stand in the way of that merger.
Yeah, Tim Carr is our guest. AT&T, I think, kind of wasted some of its money, although it has a great deal to waste. They gave $200,000 to Donald Trump's personal lawyer at the time, Michael Cohen, remember, in 2017, because they said they wanted to get his, quote, insights into understanding the new administration, close quote. My words are dripping with sarcasm. And, of course, Trump turned out to do what AT&T didn't want it to do, which was to scotch its takeover of Time Warner because, as Tim Carr said, because of his personal animus around CNN. I mean, the public must be involved, because unless we, the people, get involved, you can see the way the machinery works. It's, you know, we're going down the same road, and it's Democrats and Republicans, although it could be worse from time to time. Tim Carr, in our last 15 seconds, how do people get involved with your group? How do they support you?
Well, public involvement is what Free Press does. And we believe that if you get engaged in media policy, that you can actually turn decisions in Washington to our favor. So you can learn more about our work at freepress.net.
Well, we were joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Oh,
call.